Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Okay, so today we're going to talk bacterial analysis variants for the next couple of days at least, perhaps more. And here's some made-up data. That's percent correct. And let's say you collected data on the effects of retention interval on memory. Retention interval is just, you know, how long between study and test. And we're giving people, 20 words or 100 words. I don't know what the hell we're doing, but we'll record the percentage correct. And you get something like, they probably would be close to this, 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24-hour retention interval, 90%, 70%, 60%. That would not be surprising at all. There's no honors thesis in this. That was found by Ebbinghaus in like 1890. So you do the analysis of variance, and you conclude that retention interval affects memory. The three groups are different. Maybe the case that these two aren't different. Who knows? You do post hocs, whatever. But you find an effect, and that wouldn't surprise you. That's a pretty standard kind of experiment, though a mundane one as it's been done 1,000 times. Pretty solid effect. Now, let's say you did something a little bit different. Instead here of doing retention interval, we're going to do levels of processing. Levels of processing is a concept that Crake and Lockhart came up with, Gus Crake and Bob Lockhart at U of T in the early 70s. I think the Crake and Lockhart 73 paper is the most cited paper in the history of psychology. So that's kind of cool. And the different levels of processing are things like let's say it's a list of words. A low level of processing would be like counting the number of ascending and descending letters. So if you had the word people, it would be, there's a two P's, they go below the line, and one L that goes above. So that's three. You just look at the word. Medium might be something like, how many syllables does it have? So you have to probably read the word out to yourself. You have to think about the meaning. And a high level of processing will be something like rate this as far as its pleasantness, right? Or maybe make up a sentence using that word, something like that, because they have to actually then think about the meaning. And you'd probably, again, get something like that, because the more deeply you process something, the better you remember it. So you do analysis of variance, and you conclude that levels of processing affects memory. Which, again, would not be surprising. But, you know, nice little experiment. So now we've got two experiments we've done. One on retention interval, one on LOP. The question then is, what level of retention interval should you have used for the levels of processing experiment? Should you have used 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours? Or something in between? And, of course, for that matter, what level of processing should you have used for retention interval? Should you have used something, a deep level, medium level, a low level, whatever? I don't know. These are questions, in fact, that there isn't really an answer to. Because all the answers you give would be correct. Right? They'd all be correct. So the question is then, what the hell are you going to do? You've got to somehow figure this out. And I just said, you know, unless it was, I guess they aren't all correct. If you had your retention interval set to be 5 years, it wouldn't be very good because there'd be no memory at all and you'd get no effect. If you had the levels of processing set, levels of processing wouldn't matter. Right? That would always, would always matter. So it's possible to think of a silly example, but typically, you know, there really isn't a right answer to this question. So you could combine the two designs. So you've got, and I know most all of you guys have taken 2127 and you've talked about these kind of factorial designs where along in the columns here, we've got retention intervals, 5 minutes, 1 hour, and 24 hours. In the rows, you've got low, medium, and high levels of processing. The G's just mean group. So we've got group 1, group 2, group 3. That just means they're different people. Group 4, 5, and 6 at medium, high, 7, 8, 9, going from 5 minutes again to 24 hours. So all I've done here is combined both kinds of designs, or both sort of both experiments into one experiment. Now at the same time, I can find out the effect of retention interval and the effect of levels of processing. Do you understand what I did here? Does that make sense? And remember, the G here just means that, like, if the numbers are, G means group, and, you know, 7 is different from 8. In other words, they're different people. We're not testing the same people over and over here. We're testing 5 people here, 5 people here, 5 people here, or whatever. And they're all different people. Okay? This is a factorial design. So now the model, we have to think about what the model is. This is what the model looks like. It's x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus epsilon. And these alphas and betas are not for type 1 and type 2 errors, okay? They mean A and B. Factor A, factor B. Those are just different independent variables. In our case, retention interval and level of processing. So we got the any score, that's what x is, equals the grand mean. Right? So far it's the same as the model we've dealt with. Plus the effect of A, and if you want to think of A as being levels of processing, go right ahead. So then B is retention interval. Here's where it gets different. We have an effect of the two things acting together, the A-B interaction. The effect of retention interval and levels of processing at the same time. And then, of course, error. So the AB effect, or the alpha beta in the model, is the effect of the two variables acting together over and above the effect of A and B by themselves. Okay? So this is A on its own, regardless of B. This is B on its own, regardless of A. This is A and B together, or A, how A and B interact, come together. Yeah?
So the effect of A, that's the main effect?
It's the main effect of A, exactly. And a main effect of B, and an interaction of A and B. Yes, exactly. Questions so far? It's not so bad, right? Really, all we've done here is we've made the model a little bit bigger, thrown another variable, and you realize these are like, it's like you had another tau in there for treatment. You have two treatments now. The thing is, you have to take into account the fact that it might be the case that levels of processing has a tremendously large effect at a short retention interval, for example, and then has a smaller effect at a medium retention interval and has no effect at all at a really long retention interval. That's what that means, that kind of thing. Notice how there I couldn't talk about one variable without mentioning the other. So a bit more about this. So not only can we look at A and B, we can look at how A and B act together or how they interact. It's kind of like the whole is more than the sum of its parts. I want to think about an example here. People with more money do better in school. Okay? They do. Well, I mean, their socioeconomic status. I realize most students have no money in their pockets. I'm talking about this, your sort of socioeconomic background. That's a true thing. People that have they get better environment, right? People that have higher IQs also do better in school, right? Right? So people that just have more sort of, let's call it raw intelligence. That shouldn't surprise you. Now, people that have really good backgrounds as far as their socioeconomic status goes and are already really smart are going to be lifted even up higher, right, than they would be just based on being smart and having a high socioeconomic status. You can look at it the other way and get depressing and say that poor people don't do as well in school from a poor background, on average, as richer people. And also, people aren't very smart, don't do as well as people that are much smarter. It must be really hard when you're from a low socioeconomic status and you're not that bright. Even harder than just being the effect of low SES and low intelligence, right? Must be hard to be people, you know, there's discrimination against Native people. We'd all accept that. It's harder to succeed at anything for Native people in Canada. They do, but it's harder. It's harder to be a woman than a man, even though, again, we don't like it, but there's sexism. It's probably extra special hard to be a Native woman. Right? So, again, those are the depressing examples. I always try to think of something happy, and it's hard. Because if I got the happy, I got to have the bad end of it. So it's kind of like that, except it's mathematical, so it shouldn't make you sad. Math shouldn't make you sad. It should make you happy. So questions about that? Do you kind of understand what I'm getting at here? The effect of one variable changes depending upon the level of some second variable. That would be a nice definition of an interaction. The effect of one variable changes depending upon the level of a second variable. The effect on your school grades of being rich is even better if you're smart. All right? You okay with this? It's making sense so far? So, if we've got two variables here, independent variables, A and B, here's our dependent is going to be on the y-axis here, right? Look what happens here. We can say that as A goes up, as A changes from A1 to A2, the dependent variable goes up, right? Because on average, A2 is higher than A1, isn't it? Right. Now, this is B1. This projector does not deal with color very well, because those are horribly different on my monitor here. Anyway, so this is B1 down here. You can see that B2, that's this line, is always above B1. But then take a look at what happens when you're at the effect of B, that's the difference between these two lines, at A2. It's much bigger at A2 than it is at A1. Yeah. That's what an interaction is, right? See, the effect of one variable changes depending upon the level of some second variable. I can't very easily talk about the effect of B without mentioning A. The effect of B is small at A1 and large at A2. I probably can just say in general, B2 is bigger than B1. Is that right? Yeah. I can just say in general that A2 is bigger than A1, but if I want to tell the whole story, I really have to say that the effect of B is bigger at A2 than it is at A1. Right? That's showing you what an interaction looks like. A lot of people have a nice little sort of mnemonic here, or I guess a rule of thumb is a better way to put it. If you graph it out and the lines aren't parallel, you probably have an interaction. Now, that doesn't mean it's significant. We'd have to worry about all that stuff. We'll get there. Right? But right now, just thinking about cell means, which is what those are, just means for whatever the hell that is that I was... I don't know what the DV is here. If we're going to talk about that, it's pretty clear then that there's a big difference here, a small difference here. It looks like an interaction. All right? Difference between B1 and B2 is smaller at A2 than it is, sorry, at A1, I should say. So the difference between B1 and B2 is smaller at A1 than it is at A2. That should be at A1. That should be at A2. Sorry. The effect of B changes depending upon the level of A. It's also the case then, by the way, that the effect of A changes depending upon the level of B. Right? They're the same thing. They're the same thing. It's just because of the way I graphed it, it's easier to see the B effect being different at A1 and A2. If I flipped it around and graphed it with B1 and B2 on the x-axis and did lines for A1 and A2, I'd still get non-parallel lines. So conceptually, is this making sense? It's good? Okay. So but when you look back at the structure model, x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus epsilon, it has assumptions, like all these models do, and some of them fall out of the model. For example, the sum of all the alphas, the individual effects of A, so the effect at A1, excuse me, and the effect at A2, they must sum to zero. So if A1 raises all scores by, say, 3 points, A2 must drop all scores by 3 points. It just must. So the sum of the individual effects, so the effect at A1, the effect at A2, the effect of A at 1, the effect of A2, they sum to zero. Which also means the effect of the Bs, the effects of the sum of the betas, must sum to zero.
Why is there a subscript J for beta?
Because just by tradition, you go I and J for, yeah, it's. And I believe that's how it's done in the book.
Yeah. Is
that because. Mike, go ahead, and then Danielle. Okay, Danielle, yes?
Is that because it's like a normally distributed curve?
No, it's not because of that. It's actually because. We're looking at deviations from a mean, right?
Right.
Okay. The model has the mean already in it, right?
Yeah.
So if the mean, which means if we could suck the mean out, right?
Right?
If we could remove that from that model, now we have our deviations from zero,
right?
And the deviations themselves have to sum to zero whenever you're doing a variance, don't they?
Yeah.
Because remember, that's what we squared. So basically, the reason that it works like this is because the math to do variance works like that.
That's what I was thinking in my head with the normal. Because I was thinking this way and then this way.
There is something about normality we'll get to. And I'll also work through a couple of sort of examples that'll help you understand. It'll show you, in fact, that it always must be the case that they'll sum to zero. But it's because of the fact that they're really variance estimates.
Right.
Yep. The sum of the alpha I beta j's, there should be a j there, also must be to zero. What that means is, again, all these extra effects, these interaction effects, themselves have to sum to zero. So if being at A1, A2, you draw that up, so A1, A2, B1, B2, if being at A1, B1 raises this, your interaction by your score by 1. That means that this one has to lower it by 1. This one must lower it by 1. That one has to add it by 1. Because they must sum to 0 across and down. And they must altogether sum to 0. Error is normally distributed independent with a mean of 0 and a variance of sigma squared. There's your normality. There's also your independence assumption. Because error is what? Error is individual differences. That means different individuals, their scores don't depend on each other. So if I know Tina's score, I don't know Joel's score, I don't know Danielle's score, I don't know Stephanie's score. Yeah, Steph?
Can you say what that is again? Error
is normally distributed and independent with a mean of 0 and a variance of sigma squared. what that really says is that even the error effects, this is where the normality thing you were thinking of, Danielle, comes into place, that the error effects have a mean of zero, right? They're normal, and they're independent, meaning that each individual, if I know your score, I don't know your score. Because error really, remember I would say this, error is just individual differences. So if the individual differences are independent, that means that all the scores are independent.
Okay, what about the variance?
And the, so we take
a... mean of zero and a variance of...
sigma squared, yeah. We just had to give it a value, so we call it sigma squared. Right? So that would mean if you four guys were in a group, right, the mean of your error score, in other words, the mean of your individual difference, must be zero, just like before, they summed to zero. But they also must be independent. So if yours was five, then and yours was five, then yours is minus five, and yours is minus five. They have to sum to zero, basically. Right? It's basically saying the same thing, but it's throwing in something else. They have to be normally distributed. All the errors. This is just one group. Now we got all these other groups we can have to deal with. That's note that's a parameter. That's in the population. Questions about these assumptions that have come out of the model? So those are directly from the model. The math of that model wouldn't work without those. We're, of course, going to do an F test here. So what are the assumptions for F? A homogeneity of variance. Right? All the group variances must be the same. Random samples. Yeah, we can just completely violate the crap out of that and nothing bad happens. That's the beauty of this. While technically we can't violate it because that makes the central limit theorem work or, you know, fall into place. We can violate it severely and it doesn't matter, which is why, for example, those of you guys next year that do an honors thesis or you guys that are doing one this year, nobody's randomly sampling humans, and you don't have to. The math still works, which is good, because if it didn't, we'd be screwed. And normal populations, and we know from central limit theorem, in fact, that that's almost completely unimportant. Again, so you can violate these two. And you can usually fix this with transformations if you have to. The biggie there was the independence. Independent observations, that's the key thing, which is the error is normal and independent with a mean of zero and a variance of sigma squared. You can't really violate that. If you can, but you can't use an L covariance anymore. Got to use something else. All right, so that's they're pretty standard assumptions. Let's do a little bit of a numerical example. Now, this is what we have here. These are cell means. I haven't given you individual scores. I've not given you individual scores here. Right? So the average at A1, B1 is 9, A2, B1 is 7, A1, B2 is 3, and A2, B2 is 1. I don't know how many individuals there were in each group. I don't know anything like that at all. We're just ignoring that for now. We know that the model says that x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus epsilon. Mu alpha beta epsilon. Well, let's take the most general thing, the thing that applies to every single score, and take it out. Well, that would be the grand mean. Well, that's 9 and 7 is 16 and 3 is 19 and 1 is 20. We're now going to divide by 4. Why do we divide by 4? Because there's 4 numbers. Right? So that's 5. The grand mean here is 5. Okay? So what have I done now? I've taken out the grand mean. I've taken 5 out of each cell. 9 minus 5 is 4. Right? 7 minus 5, 2, etc. All I've done is now taken the 5 out. Yes, Stephanie?
Why did you take the 5 out?
Excuse me. What I'm doing is we're breaking it down to its constituent parts. starting with the most general thing, the thing that applies to every single cell, right? And the most general thing is the grand mean, because by definition, it applies to everything. So what I'm trying to do is get the score. I'm trying to isolate the effects of A and B and AB. But to make it a little clearer, you should take the grand mean out, because then you can start to... It just makes the math a little bit easier to do. You don't have to do it, but it makes it a little bit easier to do. So, with the grand mean removed, we can now get the effects of A and B. Now, remember I said that the elevation and depression of scores due to B, that's basically what the B effect is, and they have to sum to zero. Well, take a look here. B1, 4 and 2 is 6. This is the sum of those. B2, negative 2 plus negative 4 is negative 6, right? We have to divide those by 2 because they're average effects of B1 and B2. Well, there's 2 numbers there, right? For each. So in other words, if you're in B1, your score goes up by 3. If you're in B2, your score goes down by 3. And while I sort of cooked this so the numbers would be whole numbers, so I wouldn't have to worry about fractions and decimals and what have you, you could make up any set of numbers, and it would always be the case, as long as you're doing the arithmetic, it's not even math, the arithmetic properly, that B1, the effects of B1 and B2, let's say, that the individual, these effects, will sum to zero. They must. It's a property of the universe. They always will. If they don't, you did it wrong. There's no way they would not sum to zero. It's impossible. It's impossible. All right, so you see what I did there? Does that make in some sense? Are you okay? Okay with this? All right. Because what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take 3 out of all the B1s, and I'm going to take negative 3 out of all the B2s. Right? So if I take 3 out of here, I'm going to get 1, negative 1, and then what? 1, yeah, negative 1. Because I'm going to take negative 3 out of all the B2s. Make sense so far? So that's what I did. Now I have 1, negative 1, 1, negative 1. I took 3 out of all of the B1s and negative 3 out of all the B2s. You okay? Everybody okay still? Yes, Tina?
So it doesn't matter which ones you do first.
No.
Right?
No. No. You could even do it by leaving the grand mean in. It gets a little more unwieldy when you leave it in there. Yeah. So now let's do A2 and A1. Well, it's going to be 2 and negative 2. I will not condescend to you to tell you that 2 divided by 2 is 1 and negative 2 divided by 2 is negative 1. So the effect of A1 is 1. If you're in A1, it raises your score by 1. If you're in A2, it depresses your score, drops your score by 1. Now, we're going to take 1 out of all the A1s and negative 1 out of all the A2s. And you're going to get nothing. Which means there was no interaction. There's just main effects of A and B. Now let me show you something. What was the grand mean again?
5.
5, right? Let's rebuild this thing. Grand mean is 5. So every cell gets 5. And B1 was it plus 3? B1 was plus 3, and B2 was minus 3. So B1s B1, yeah, gets 3. And B2s lose 3. And then, oh, it's gone there. What was A1? Which one was 1? Was it A1 or A2? A1 was 1? So, for all the A1s, we add 1. For all the A2s, we subtract 1. 5 and 3 is 8, and 1 is 9. 5 minus 3 is 2, and 1 is 3. Oh, yeah, that's right. Or that's, no, sorry. 5 minus 3 minus 1, so it's 2. Am I doing that right? Yeah, that's right. It has a plus. I just, my handwriting's bad. 5 and 3 is 8, minus 1 is 7. 5 minus 3 is 2, minus 1 is 1. Go back to the original, you will see that those are the scores. Right? Yeah, it is really neat. And I think when you do it that way and sort of rebuild it, you can actually see that they must sum to 0. This is a way to check your work, by the way, if you're ever doing one of these, if you're breaking down one of these tables like on a quiz. Just redo it and see, does it come back in? Oh, yeah, I'm fine. If you'll graph this, by the way, you would have seen that we have an effective A. Look, A2 is smaller than A1. We have an effective B. B1 is bigger than B2. And the lines are parallel. We do not have an interaction. I can very confidently talk about the effective A ignoring this, the level of B. I can talk about the effective B ignoring the level of A. I can just say that B1's bigger than B2 and A1's bigger than A2. I don't have to say, but at B2 it's like this. If I have to stop and say that, I have an interaction. But I don't. Right? Yeah, Kim.
Can you then explain disordinal and ordinal interactions?
I will. Yeah. I'll get there. Questions so far? Very mechanical doing this. Yes, Stephanie.
Going back to the previous slide.
Yep.
We had all zeros.
Yep.
And if there was an interaction?
There would be numbers, in, there would be non-zero values in there, but they would sum to 0 across and down.
Okay.
So if we had 6, negative 6, negative 6, 6. Yeah. Yeah. Which would be sort of a satanic interaction of some sort, I guess. Yeah, it is. Right. Other questions? Okay. Let's do another one. 20, 0, negative 10, 2. So A1, B1 is 20, A2, B1 is 0, A1, B2 is negative 10, A2, B2 is 2. A2, B2, which was the stand-in for R2, D2. Thank you very much. I'll be here all week. Something, 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 dark side. Grand mean, well, you can work that out. It's 3. 20 minus 10, it's 10. How's it 3? 22 minus 10, 12. Okay, yeah, that's right. 12, I was doing the math wrong. So that's 12 divided by 4 is 3. Yeah. So now we just take 3 out. Take 3 out of all of them. Now again, you could do this leaving it there, but it I always find it much more clear to take the grand mean out, because then I can very easily see the effects. Like, it just makes more sense to me. So, grand mean comes out, we get 17 minus 3, negative 3 and negative 1 going across. Now we sum them, 17 minus 13 is 4, negative 3 plus negative 1 is negative 4. We have to divide by 2. This is a thing a lot of people forget. They never forget to divide by, say, 4 or whatever the number of cells, but then when they do the individual effects, they forget to do the division, or they divide by 4 again. Remember, it's just an average. Right? And it comes from 2. It comes from 2. So it's 2 for a 1 and negative 2 for a 2. And again, it's summing to 0. 2 and negative 2 sum to 0. You okay so far? Yes, please.
Wait, when do you divide by 2? Because it's like 17 minus 13 is 4. So
4 divided by 2. Because it's the average effect of A1. And you've got the total effect of A1, the total before, but the average for those two is 2, because if they divide by 2.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Good. Say 2 from all the A1s and negative 2 from all the A2s. Remember, you're always subtracting. And when you subtract a negative number, you actually add the number. You know what I'm saying? Right? So, okay. Not gone, it's gone. I don't know what gone would mean. It looks like something in Latin. Gone A. Yeah, it's a special. That's right. It's not Latin, it's Staten, which is what they named that island in New York after, Staten Island, is named after statistics. No, I'm kidding. I'm very good at making things up like that, and sometimes people believe me.
Yeah.
So, notice how the cells sum to zero, which is kind of cool. I've taken out A, I've taken out the grand mean. But notice also, though, that the cells sum to zero, the A's sum to zero, but the B's don't, because we haven't taken B out yet. They sum to 14 and minus 14, so that means the effects are 7, what are called the simple main effects, are 7 and minus 7.
Dave, could we have done B first?
Sure. Yeah. Yep. So if you don't take the grand mean out, the cells aren't going to sum to zero like that. Like I said, for me, it makes it easier to see if I take the grand mean out. Make sense? You okay? Yeah? All right. So I'll take 7 out of B1 and take negative 7 out of B2. And we get 8, negative 8, negative 8, 8. So we have an interaction here. Again, note the effects sum to zero in every possible way except diagonally, which sort of, it's not like it's tic-tac-toe. They all together sum to zero, they sum to zero across, and they sum to zero down. Yeah, well, I took out 7. Let's go back. Fifteen minus 7 is 8.
Oh.
Right? Negative 1 minus 7, negative 8. Negative 15 minus negative 7, negative 8. 1 minus negative 7, 8. You guys okay? Yeah. Sure? You good? Okay. So there's the interaction. If we're just zeros again, we would have no interaction. If it's just zeros, there is no interaction. Yeah, sorry.
So why do you have to go through all this to figure out if there's an interaction you can just grab?
You can. The thing is, what part of what this does, for example, is we're completely ignoring individual effects. Those are just cell meetings that I have up there, right? Now, the interesting thing is here, I can tell you right now what the sum of squares for interaction is. 64, 64, 128, 256.
This just makes the math easier?
Yeah, and it partly does that. I mean, and in essence, this is what the math does, right? Because it's all these deviations from means. I've just taken the grand mean out to look at the deviations, make it a little bit easier. So, and how did I get that, by the way? These are deviation scores. 8 squared, 64. 8 squared, 64, 128. Plus 128 is 256. So now I know the sum of squares for interaction. The sum of squares for B, that was 7 and minus 7, right? So it's 98, 49 and 49, right? So it's, in essence, that's what this is doing. Now, again, we're ignoring the individual differences here. This is more to sort of show you where stuff comes from.
Because in reality, when you do this, you should have another number left over other than the zeros, which would be your zero, like your error. But then your critical value should take that into account.
If you did this just with cell means on real data, everything would work like this. Exactly like this. The thing is, you'd also have to get deviations from cell means of individual scores. Right? So if, and what was the example I used before? 5, negative 5, negative 5, 5, let's say. Then within this cell, right, the sum of squares for error, and then you'd have to add it to all the other cells, would be 25, 70, 100. Right? Because 5 squared plus 5 squared plus 5 squared plus 5 squared. Yep. And that'd be the sum of squares for error. Then we'd have another group that might be plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, plus 1. Another group be 5, you know, 6, negative 6, 6, negative 6, 6, whatever. Right? But if you just did this on cell means to your own data, you would actually, it would work exactly like this, except there'd be a lot of decimal places, probably. The only way I've cooked these is to make it so the math, I didn't have to worry about fractions. Yeah, Mike?
Even if we had 3 independent variables,
would work? Yep. Work with 27 independent variables. It'd be a horrible thing to do, but you could do it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. On our final exam in our that third year stats course I've told you about that I took at Western, it was kind of like this. The one where the person had the panic attack in the final. One of our questions, it was a 4-hour final exam. One of the questions we had 5 independent variables we had to do this. And it's horrible because you're just going over and over. It's mechanical, but there's so many places to make a mechanical error. And then you'd end up going, you make a mistake and go, okay, I've got to start over. This so far has taken me 35 minutes and there are 29 questions on this test. But yeah, it's something that, in essence, when you're doing, what this is meant to show you is that the variance can comes from different places. So each cell mean, as we saw here, is made up of a grand mean, an effective A, an effective B, and an interaction effect. Right? So yeah, if you did just graph this, you'd see that the lines crossed. That's hardly... That's an interaction. That's a classic, beautiful, wonderful interaction. These things do happen. Thing is, though, when you look at that graph, you can't tell me, I can't easily see if there's an effective A or an effective B. It's hard for me to say, is A1 bigger than A2? Is B1 bigger than B2? I think A1 is probably a little bit bigger than A2. I have trouble with that graph looking and saying, I guess B1's bigger than B2. Probably. But by breaking the table down like that, we saw, yeah, there was an A effect, a B effect, and an interaction. Yes, Stephanie.
So for this example, if we did the grand mean, A effect, B effect, we have to also add 8, negative 8, depending on the interaction. The previous example was just 0.
Well, they were 0, so I didn't do them. Yeah, that's right. Give you a bit of a real-world example of something that is an interaction. So if you had... Whoops. If you were doing recalling words or doing memory tests with words, you had a retention interval of 5 minutes and 24 hours, and you had what's called an explicit memory test, which is one where I ask you to recall the words, right? You know that this is going to decline. So we'll call this explicit. That's recall. It wouldn't be that drastic, but for the sake of demonstrating it. Now, if I use something else, like word fragment completion, so if I just gave you the words with like letters missing and had you fill in the blanks, you actually do better on ones you just studied compared to ones you haven't studied. Even though you don't need that memory to solve the task, you do a bit better on those. It's called an implicit memory task. The neat thing is, if you do it 24 hours later, there's no change. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah, we can do that. I'll do that as soon as I've talked about this. So, in the real world, for example, here's an interaction effect. And the original article here is Tolving, Schachter, and Stark, 1983, if you want to look it up. It's a classic priming article. Would you be confident here in saying that memory decays? Would you be confident in saying that implicit memory is better than explicit memory? Be hard to say. What would you be able to say? I can tell you that implicit memory doesn't decay and explicit memory does. Oh, that sounds like I'm talking about two variables and I have to mention the level of the second variable. So that's an interaction. But yeah, you want me to go back and build that other one up? Let's do it. So we need the values here. What was the grand mean again? 3? Okay. So let's put 3 in all these. What was the A1 and A2? It's 2 and negative 2, you said? Right. 2 and negative 2. A1 is 2. A2 is negative 2, so A1 is 2 plus 2 plus 2 minus 2 minus 2. Good. For the B's, B1 is 7, and B2 is negative 7. So B1, we add 7 to all those, and we subtract 7 here. And now finally, the interaction is going to be like this, plus 8, minus 8, minus 8. All right. Let's see. 3 and 2 is 5, and 7 is 12, and 8 is 20. Let's see, 3 minus 2 is 1, and 7 is 8, minus 8 is 0. 3 and 2 is 5, minus 7 is negative 2, minus 8 is negative 10. 3 minus 2 is 1, minus 7 is minus 6, plus 8 is 2. Is that what we had at the beginning? Yeah? So you probably just made a mechanical error.
Oh, we didn't add the interaction.
Ah, yes. You always had, that's the, right? Okay. Other questions? You guys, now, back to my example with priming of explicit and priming implicit memory and explicit memory and 5 minutes and 24 hours. In this case, it would be very difficult for us to talk about retention interval effects without mentioning the kind of memory test it is. In fact, you can't. You can't. However, when you do the statistics, it's like we just saw one. We had two main effects in that other example. But looking at the graph, it would be very difficult to say, yeah, well, A1's bigger than A2, and B1's, you got to say, except if it's at B2, then it flips around. That's what happens here. With this example, you could say, I bet there really is a main effect of memory test type. I bet implicit's better than explicit. I bet there really is, on average, an effective retention interval, 24 hours versus 5 minutes. But I can also tell you that that effect completely flips around depending upon the other variable. I cannot talk about one without mentioning the other. It is impossible. So you got to be really careful interpreting interactions in the presence of main effects. Oh, sorry, interpreting main effects in the presence of interactions. Well, it's sort of... Yeah, it's sort of true with the other thing, but that's a better way to put it. With an ordinal interaction, too bad. Tina's gone. An ordinal interaction where the order of the main effects is preserved, you can do it. It's a little easier. So an ordinal interaction is more like this, where you'd have something like... like that, where you can see that while the effect of B is bigger at A2 than it is at A1, I can still say that B2 is bigger than B1. And I can say that on average, yeah, that's just true. Right? I don't feel bad about talking about that. That's a little easier to do. When the order of the main effects is preserved in the presence of an interaction. Whereas a disordinal interaction, which is what we have over here on the right, it's almost impossible to interpret main effects here. Because interpretation involves making statements. It's not just the numbers. Now you got to say, this means this. You know, I'm very happy with results like this saying, this means that implicit memory doesn't decay and explicit memory does. I don't mention any difference between the two tasks, that one's better than the other, because I can't. And in fact, a lot of our theories in science in general are about interactions, right? And especially in psychology, think about things like sex differences. You say, males are better than females on average at spatial tasks, and females are better than males at verbal tasks. I just described the interaction to you. We have two kinds of tasks and two sexes. Lines cross. So it's really a lot harder. In fact, I think maybe impossible. Some people say, if you have an interaction, don't even talk about main effects. And I think if you can reasonably do it, you should. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But there are people out there, and that's a matter of preference, will say never talk about main effects in the presence of an interaction. Well, I mean, you could just draw the picture, but why don't you just say that the order of main effects is preserved in the presence of an interaction for an ordinal interaction, and the order of the main effects is not preserved in the presence of an interaction. That's what a disordinal interaction is. You could draw the picture. It's fine. Don't just say the lines cross. That one kind of bugs me. Or the lines don't cross. Because that can mean virtually anything. What lines? Lines of cocaine? Crossing the streams in Ghostbusters? You don't ever cross the streams. They're making a remake of that, right? I think so. I ain't afraid of no ghosts. No. Who you got to call? All right. Questions so far? Are you good? Okay. Now, remember with the simple ANOVA, the one way, we partition the sums of squares and the degrees of freedom. We're going to do the same thing here. And in fact, most of it's going to look exactly like the simple ANOVA. So remember, our model is x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus epsilon. So what we have to do is get a sum of squares for A, a sum of squares for B, a sum of squares for AB, and a sum of squares for epsilon. Because those are the... You don't get a sum of squares for the mean because it doesn't vary. right? So that tells us we need sums of squares of A, B, and error. And the other thing is, those will add up to be total. So sum of squares total equals sum of squares A plus sum of squares B plus sum of squares AB plus sum of squares error. You look sad.
Me?
Yeah. Is it okay?
No.
Okay. What's wrong? No, what's wrong? Unless it's something really weird and personal. I mean, if it's with the class.
I don't get all the sum of squares stuff.
Okay. The idea here is, remember, that's about variance, right? It's why it's called analysis of variance, okay? So we're going to see how much the A's vary, how much the B's vary, and how much the A's and B's vary. That's what we did before, breaking down the table. That's really all that is. Now, does that make sense so far? Okay. Now, think about variance. Simplest kind of variance when you're just doing it for a single like batch of data, right? It's the sum of the squared deviations from the mean divided by the number of observations minus 1. That's what variance is. So the sum of the squared deviations from the mean divided by the number of observations minus 1. Note the words in there, the sum of the squared deviations from the mean, the sum of squares. So what we're doing is we're getting variance that can be accounted for by being in group A1 or A2 or whatever, variance that can be accounted for by being in B1 or B2, variance that is accounted for by being in A1, B1, A2, B2, right? And then finally, variance that's because you're you and you're you and you're you. Well, that's the degrees of freedom for it. We'll worry about that in a second. Let's worry about the top part of a variance, which is just what? They're sums of squared deviations. And you had your hand up?
Yes, I know sum of squares is A, B, and E. And E isn't the kind of
defined by the number. Probably, I'll tell you in a second. Probably not this slide, probably the next slide.
Okay.
Yeah. Think of it this way. Sum of squares A is the squared deviations of column means, if we have A in columns, the squared deviations of column means from the grand mean. And again, that's why it makes it a little easier if you break down the table to suck out that grand mean.
Okay.
Yep.
So for this, you would just say, in the previous example, 4 and negative 4?
Was that what the A and B were? Or A1 and A2 were? Yeah.
Before you divide by 2 or after you divide by 2?
Oh, after.
Okay, so it would be 2 and negative 2.
Yeah, so it's going to be 8. 2 squared and negative 2 squared. Yeah. That's right. Subtract what?
It's what we subtracted.
Yeah, that's right. They're deviations from the grand mean.
So we're not really something new. We're just going to say something different, right?
I think you could look at it that way. Sum of squares B is the square deviations of row means. And again, that's if you put B in rows. So I just do that sort of because I do it that way. From the grand mean. And I think that was, what, 7 and negative 7 for that example? So that's going to be 98. 49 plus 49. Right? 7 squared minus 7 squared. Added 2 up. I summed the squares. Summed the square deviations. I like sitting here. It's good. I think I'm in your way. Am I in your way? No? Okay. Because I really, this is good.
So for A,
yep.
When it was 2 and negative
2,
that's
8 then? Yep. Why did you just cube 2? Oh, I see what you did. Okay. Because 2 times 2 is 2 squared,
yeah.
And then you did it twice. Okay.
Oh, okay.
No, I thought you were like thinking of the sums of cubes. I've never seen that one. So. And then you do the sums of cubes for no reason, but it's fun. I like cubing numbers. Now, keep thinking about this. The sum of squares AB, that's the weird one. Because those other ones before are just like treatment effects. They're just like the effect of sum of squares of treatments in the plain old analysis of variance, except we got 2 treatments. Here, we got to think about AB, and that's squared deviations of cell means That's like A1, B1, A2, B2, etc. From what we would expect, given only the row and column means. Yes, Stephanie?
So, for the last example where we had an interaction, the row and column means were zero.
No, they weren't. The column means weren't zero. That was because we'd taken them away. Remember we took them out?
We had 8, -8, -8, -8.
Yeah, that's right. Those actually themselves are the deviations from what we would expect given the column means. So the sum of squares for AB in that case would be 256. Because 8 squared plus 8 squared plus 8 squared plus 8 squared is 256. Yes?
Oh, so you looked at each individual.
Mm-hmm. See? It says cell means, right? Well, sum of squares error are square deviations of individual scores from cell means. We didn't have values for individual scores. Yeah? Of SSAB?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we had... What would we have? We had 8,
yeah.
Negative 8, negative 8, and 8.
Yeah.
Okay? Those are deviations from what we would expect in those cell means if we had just the A effect and the B effect. Right? Because if it was just the A effect and B effect, those would all be zeros. But we didn't get zeros. We got 8, negative 8, negative 8, and 8. So if we wanted to get the sum of squares for AB, for that, in that case, we would get 256. Because 8 squared plus 8 squared plus, well, 8 squared plus negative 8 squared plus negative 8 squared plus 8 squared equals 256. All right. Sum of squares error, we didn't have any numbers for that. I didn't give you individual values, so let's not worry about that. But if you were calculating that, if you four guys here... we're all in one of the groups, and y'all differed, like, Danielle was up 1, Stephanie was down 1, Joel was up 1, and Mike would be down 1. It'd be 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? You can do that. It makes doing these kind of examples really evil, so I just didn't have it. And I don't think it demonstrates a great deal. Because all you're doing is calculating sum of squares for that group, then calculating the sum of squares for this group, and then for this group, and then for this group. Yeah?
For the sum of squares error, the cell means.
Yes.
Are you using the cell means with the grand mean taken?
No.
Because of the original value.
They would have to be there. Yeah. That's right. You could do that if you'd also take it away from every individual, the effect of A, the effect of B, and the interaction value. Yeah, see, that's why I said it's really so painful to do that doing it is... You can do it. When I was in third year in a course like this at Western, it was a full-year course, and we had to do two experiments and write them up. And the first experiment you did was a correlational one, and the second one was an experiment. And I was at home, and it was before you could, I didn't have a modem, because remember this is 1987. I would have to dial into the university to do my data analysis, and I didn't feel like going to the university, so I actually wrote a computer program to do analysis of variance, and it had to do that. It's very repetitive, it was quite easy. But it was a pain. But that would work, and it did work. It got me reasonable values. So more precisely, worry so much. That's the sum of squares, x minus x bar sub g, right? That's total. N is the number of subjects. Okay, q is the number of levels of, that's going to be A. P is the number of levels of B. Row mean, or sorry, is it column? No, it's column mean minus grand mean squared. Row mean minus grand mean squared. Individual scores minus grand mean done a whole bunch of times. This is the one that's weird. Because this one here, this is the interaction one. What I've done here is I've got the individual score. I've subtracted the row mean, the column mean. Now, if I've subtracted the row mean and the column mean, if I've done that, I've actually taken out the grand mean as well. So I've got to put it back in. That's why it's plus G. It doesn't matter a great deal. You'd never do this by hand. But we know that the degrees of freedom are going to be n minus 1 for the whole thing. Sum of squares, for sum of squares total, it's n minus 1. For the A's, for the effective A, well, it's the number of levels of A minus 1. Well, why is that? Well, what do we have here? This was, if we have an effect for A, if it's plus 2 for A1, what is it for B, for A2? It's got to be minus 2. We've lost the degree of freedom. So it's going to be the same for B. Right? Yes, Stephanie?
What is A, B, where you use Q and P earlier?
Those are the number, that's just notation. It's the number of levels of A and B. Yeah.
But Q is the number of levels of A as well.
Yes.
So it's a little more variable to me?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're never going to have to repeat that, so don't worry too much about it. Now, for, No. Well, if you go to the little tutorials and Stephanie shows you, Amy shows you how to use the PAW37XJ, you know, it's no problem. For the interaction main effect, for the interaction degrees of freedom, it's A minus 1 times B minus 1. Because think about this. They have to sum to 0 in every possible way. So if we got that here, A1, A2, B1, B2, give me a number.
Six,
very good. Oh, that's it. That's the last. That's the only one we can assign freely. -6, -6, -6. It's number of levels of A, -1. Times the number of levels of B, -1. So that's the degree. That's the degrees of freedom for the interaction. And finally, within each cell, we calculate a score for each individual. Right, we do it a whole bunch of times. So it's n minus 1. With little n is the number of subjects per group. Right? Number of subjects per group. And we do it A times B times. Right? Because it's number of subjects in group 1 minus 1. Then we do it again for group 2, again for group 3, again for group 4. How many groups do we have? A times B. A times B. Oh, sorry. I thought I had a point underneath there. The only thing that's different is this. This is new. You're saying, wait a second, Dave, that used to be K times N minus 1. K groups. Well, now how many groups do you have? A times B. It's the number of groups times the number of subjects per group minus 1. That's all it is. Yeah?
If little n is number of subjects per group,
it's
big N.
Total number of subjects in the experiment is big N. All right? What say we stop there? Well, it is 11:15.
Logical monsters, cried the terrified mathematician. Every one of them was a splinter in my eye. I hate the Pino space in the Coke curve. I fear the Cantor ternary set. The Sierpinski gasket makes me wanna cry. And a million miles away, a butterfly left its wings on a cold November day. A man named Benoit Mandelbrot was born.
face those demons down. They saw that infinite complexity could be described by simple rules. Used a giant brain and turned the game around. And below the storm, saw a vision in his head. A bulbous pointed form, picked his pencil up and he wrote his secret down. Just pick a point called T in the complex plane. Let's see, one BZ squared plus C. Z2 is Z1 squared plus C. Z3 is Z2 squared plus C. And so on. If the series of Z's will always stay close to Z and never trend away, that point is in the Mandelbrot set. Mandelbrot set, you're a Rorschach test on fire, a table pterodactyl. You're a heart-shaped box of springs and wire in one badass fucking fractal. And you're just in time to save the day, sweeping all our fears away. You can change the world in a tiny way. Mandelbrot's in heaven, at least he will be when he's dead. Right now he's still alive and teaching math at Yale. Gave us order out of chaos, he gave us hope where there was none. His geometry succeeds where others fail. If you ever lose your way, butterfly will flap its wings from a million miles away. A little miracle will come to take you home. Just take a point called T in the complex plane. Let's see, one BZ squared plus C. Z2 is Z1 squared plus C. Z3 is Z2 squared plus C. And so on. If the series of Z's will always stay close to Z and never trend away, that point is in the Mandelbrot set. Mandelbrot set, you're a Rorschach test on fire, you're a Deagle pterodactyl. You're a heart-shaped box of springs and wire, you're one badass fucking fractal. And you're just in time to save the day, sweeping all our fears away. You can change the world in a tiny way. And you're just in time to save the day, sweeping all our fears away. You can change the world in a tiny way. Go on, change the world in a tiny way. Come on, change the world in a tiny way.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share like 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.